Join us WrestleMania weekend for the Internet Darlings live event featuring your favorite wrestling YouTubers. The link is in the description. Hey, friendo, Steve here.
And Larson.
Yeah, welcome back to Going In Raw, Count Out, the only other pro wrestling podcast we know of right here at youtube.com/ Steve Larson, also available wherever fine podcasts are, including iTunes, where if you guys hit that subscribe download button, even if you're watching here on YouTube, it jacks us up in the sports and rec category there on the iTunes top 50 ranking thing, genre thing.
Yes.
And then we're also available at soundcloud.com/ Steven Larson, Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and hopefully soon to be Spotify.
Yes, hopefully very soon.
We're not making any promises on that
No.
one, though. We're also at Patreon at patreon.com/ Steven Larson if you want to contribute to the phone, to the show. We have all sorts of rewards that we're offering up, as in watching the live stream every single week when we do our Raw live streams.
Or getting a t-shirt.
Or getting a t-shirt. Or speaking of t-shirts, we also have a Pro Wrestling Tees shop at prowrestlingtees/ Going In Raw.
Yes.
Yeah, where you can get. Right now we have four designs. Today's Friday. I'm going to work on another design today.
Good.
I don't know what it's going to be.
Whatever happened to the Ulysses one?
Oh, yeah. Probably going to finish that one. I'm going to do that one.
Okay.
Yeah, but anyways, this is a count out. We're about to count something down, Larson.
Yes.
This past week on SmackDown, we saw something kind of odd happen. Randy Orton committed arson.
Yeah, well, it was a segment. Usually, you know, the era we're in now, they don't typically do a whole lot of these very cinematic segments.
They spent a lot of money on this, Randy.
Yeah,
Orton.
And it was fairly edgy. Because we can discuss this. We will discuss this in much greater detail in a little bit. But what are we going to do today on this episode of Countdown, Steve?
Well, to us, that Randy Orton thing was a WTF moment.
Yeah.
And we thought, what other sort of story WTF moments that kind of came out of left field?
Yes.
Or have there been in professional wrestling? And there's been a lot of them.
Oh, yes.
And we kind of stayed away from stuff that strayed more into backstage politics spilling into the storyline.
Yes.
So, for example, Hogan and Vince Russo sort of jawing at each other at Bash at the Beach.
Hulk Hogan, you son of a, or you piece of shit.
Hulk Hogan, you piece of shit.
You started out as a Piper there.
Oh, Hogan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I almost thought you said Hulk Hogan, you son of a bitch, but
this is like moments that if I'm sitting there as a wrestling fan watching this, which I was for a lot of these, it's like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
WTF moments. Number 10.
10.
RoboCop. He showed up in WCW.
Yeah, this was the tie-in with the release of RoboCop 2, which is a very gritty movie.
Yeah,
exceptionally gritty movie. Like, I remember watching this movie when this was 1990, so I'd have been, when it came out in video, so 13, 14 years old. I remember watching RoboCop 2 and being freaked out by it.
Yeah.
Because this is a weird,
what were some
weird
of the
movie.
I don't know if I'm almost positive I saw it, but nothing.
It's the one where, remember the actor's name. I could see his face, though.
Okay.
There's a drug called Nuke.
Okay, that sounds vaguely familiar.
That's taking over Detroit.
Okay.
And RoboCop has to put an end to it.
Oh, okay.
It's a really gritty, grim movie.
Yeah.
Really violent.
Well, okay, the first
really
one
messed
the
up.
First one was too, though.
I know, but the first one was balanced with some dark humor.
Yeah, I know, but then they made like a cartoon about it. Like they try to
weird.
Turn it into a kid's
it's
franchise.
It's so weird.
It is really weird.
But RoboCop 2 is not. It's a messed up movie.
Okay,
it's a really messed up movie.
But I'll
so
check
it's
that
it's
out.
Odd that they thought, okay, how can we promote this movie? Let's get it on a wrestling program.
Okay, so were you able to find out if there was any buildup? Okay, so the pay per view literally was called Capital Combat: Return of RoboCop. So this is a big integration. This
yes.
is a huge sales integration.
Yeah, they tied the entire show around RoboCop.
Even though he only appeared like once.
Yeah.
Or he appeared like twice when he showed up and then when his actual segment happened. There was a 30-second promo that you can find online where Sting kind of introduces RoboCop into the equation
via
a commercial.
Sting is combating the Four Horsemen who, just the year prior, 1989, Sting was a member of the Four Horsemen.
Yeah.
He earned a title shot
against Ric Flair.
Ric Flair demanded that he relinquish his title shot or get kicked out of the Horsemen.
Well, yeah.
He got kicked out of the Horsemen because he's not giving up his title shot.
That's fair, though.
Yes.
I mean, it's that's your buddy. Don't, you know.
Friendly competition.
You know.
Yeah.
Solidarity.
During that show, Sting blew out his knee, so Luger got the title shot instead. Sting came back, got immediately into a program with the Four Horsemen. By this point, Sid was the fourth member of the Horsemen, along with Flair, Ole Anderson, and Arn Anderson.
Right.
So Sting brought RoboCop in to help him combat the Horsemen.
Right. And so so at the following, I believe it was a match for the NWA United States Tag Team Championships, Sting makes his return. The Horsemen are out there. They lock up Sting in this little shark cage that had been out there to put Jim Cornette in there previously. Jim Cornette said in a shoot interview after the fact that the cage had been obviously gimmicked so that RoboCop can rip the door off.
Well, I mean, he didn't rip the door off. What it was is the hinges weren't locked on. All he did do was lift the door up and moved it. Well, you can see it plain as day in the video.
According to Cornette, he couldn't move around too much because if he touched the door, he said that thing was going to fly off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they put Sting in there. RoboCop saunters out. That was a saunter.
That's even generous. What's slower than a saunter?
I mean, technically a millabout, like when you're milling, but that's sort of standing still.
No, milling seems aimless, though.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, yeah. RoboCop had purpose.
This is directional milling.
I guess so. I mean, in the movie, it's not like he moves fast.
Right, I know. He lumbers, I guess? Is lumber slower than he lumbers?
Because sauntering makes it seem casual, but there's nothing casual about what RoboCop is doing. He had purpose.
Yeah, he lumbers there.
That's
my favorite
word.
Part of the entire thing is Ole Anderson, who is well known to be like, but Ole, I think, came up with Shockmaster. So Ole is he's no stranger. It's the Ole Anderson, there's this like hilarious dichotomy where he seemed to be behind some really goofy shit, but he seemed to be the grumpiest no BS guy in the entire company. Like everybody always said that Ole was grumpy.
Yeah.
And so to see him react to RoboCop as if it was a shoot is hilarious. And Arn Anderson too, but Arn seems like kind of a fun-loving dude.
Yeah.
So anyway, and Sid.
Sid kind of had the same expression throughout the whole segment.
Exactly, which is like Sid. I don't think Sid was terribly great at like hiding his actual emotions.
Yeah.
I think what Sid was feeling in here, it was on his face.
Pretty much.
And I think Sid understood this was goofy as shit. Sid was trying to figure out ways to take down RoboCop.
Probably.
And I think in his mind, he could.
You know, Sid was involved in two of the goofiest segments in WCW history. This one. And he was there for the Shockmaster, too.
Yeah, that's right. He was there. And I think I remember seeing on Sid's face during the Shockmaster sequence that he felt he could take down the Shockmaster. I think Sid is...
Well, I mean, Wall took down the Shockmaster, so I think Sid would be fine doing that, too.
I think Sid is always measuring his opponents, no matter big or small.
That could be.
Anyway,
so Sting is locked in this cage.
Yeah, RoboCop.
RoboCop comes up and bends the bars... Obviously gimmicked.
The bars look completely different than all the other bars.
Yeah, yeah. So he bends the bars right in the door of the cage and then just very gingerly lifts the door off the hinges and then removes the door.
Because there was no bolt. Like there was no bolt.
No.
That's the thing.
No.
It was, you know, you put a door on a frame in a door frame. And if you don't put the things in, it just comes. Well, it was just sort of gingerly there. And so he just sort of takes it off. And then they approach the Horsemen, and the Horsemen run off or whatever.
It was a very anticlimactic ending to the segment.
Oh, yeah, totally. Everybody just saunters away.
But it's just one of the stranger integrations in probably wrestling history.
Yeah. I mean, there's this. We can also talk, because this isn't on the list. We can also talk about there's the Kiss one.
Oh, the Demon?
The Demon.
Yeah.
Where, like, Kiss got paid, I think, $500,000.
Wow.
To perform. And also part of the deal was the Kiss Demon had to perform in a certain number of matches. But, like, that segment where Kiss performed was, like, 98, 99. I think it was 99.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe 2000. I remember watching that live.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Well, we were a couple of the only ones because that segment was one of the worst performing segments in the entirety of the Monday Night Wars.
Wow.
Yeah. So they really killed themselves there. Number nine.
Nine.
Mae Young gives birth to a hand.
Also very weird.
Very strange.
I remember watching this live, too.
I remember watching this live as well, thinking this is fucked up. But it was kind of, this is like in the thick of the Attitude era.
Yeah, this was, 99, 2000 or so?
I think it was 1999. I had the dates on most of these. Let's see here. This was so.
Yeah,
anyways,
look that up. I'll set it up. Mark Henry,
yeah,
and Mae Young were an item during this period.
Well,
he was.
He was a. He was a sex addict. Sexual chocolate was his nomen. Was his sort of, you know, his title.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved sex. He was fucking everything.
Yeah.
So continue.
This episode of Raw. Do you know what episode it is?
No.
The date.
Continue.
Okay.
It was 2000.
Oh, it was 2000? Yeah. Okay. During a match between Mark Henry and Crash Holly for the WWF Hardcore title, Mae Young got involved, did a splash on Crash Holly, and then she collapsed to the mat in some sort of discomfort.
Yeah.
And then subsequently.
It's not because she was like 70 years old on Crash Holly.
Yeah. Fast forward. And in a different segment, backstage, they show Mae giving birth to what we thought would be a child.
Yeah, but it turned out it was a hand. It was like a fake hand with a bunch of viscous on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, stuff comes out of the belly when you're giving birth.
Yes. I remember watching that and just being confused.
Yeah, it was very odd.
Why just a hand?
Yeah, and Vince Russo wants everybody to know that he was not even with the company at the
time. No, he left in 99.
Yeah, so it was not a Vince Russo moment.
I still don't understand why it was a hand.
I don't know. But they brought it back up on the Raw 1000 episode in 2012, I believe, where they had some dude, and I tried to look up who it was. Oh, that was the other thing about RoboCop. We don't really know who played RoboCop.
Oh, yes.
According to Jim Cornette...
They paid Peter Weller a huge sum of money. Yeah.
Yeah. But then if you look at him, you cannot tell, and nobody really knows who it was.
Does RoboCop talk during the 30-second promo?
Yeah, he does. But I can't really tell. Like, I don't think that's Weller. It didn't seem like it was Peter Weller. Was Weller in the second one?
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. But he wasn't in the third one.
Nope.
Interesting. So anyways, going back to the hand. Yeah, they had some dude dress up in a hand costume. And say hi to Mae Young. It was her. It was the hand. It was the hand grown up.
Yeah.
He had glasses on. Some low-level WWE writer, no doubt. So anyways, yeah, that was weird. A little weird.
Yeah, that was weird. Very
WTF,
weird.
WTF, yeah. Number eight.
Eight.
Randy Orton burns down the Wyatt compound. Yeah, that was one of the weirder things that we've seen.
In recent memory, yeah.
Really, really dark.
It was. So I'm sure pretty much everybody's seen it. But a brief recap.
Yeah.
Bray Wyatt comes out to give his invocation at the end of this past week's SmackDown.
Yes.
So he compares himself to the devil, essentially, and alludes that Randy Orton himself is currently in hell.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing, if you think about it.
Yeah.
And so they cut to the Titantron, and there's Randy at the Wyatt compound because, you know, 2 weeks prior, Bray gave Randy the keys to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never took literally.
Yeah, I know.
You know, but anyways, apparently it was.
We joked about it.
Yeah.
The keys of the kingdom were simply a spare set of keys to the Wyatt compound.
Yeah.
Evidently, that was literal.
Yeah, that was literal.
And so, I like that he thinks that his shitty little shack is a compound, is a kingdom.
Yeah, I know. So Randy, you know, he more or less, to paraphrase, he says, you know, Bray, this may be, you know, your land, but it's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said when if you can't beat him, join him. But a phrase I like more is wait till the right time, then screw him.
Screw him.
And then he says, below, you know, in Wyatt family promos, there's always that rocking chair, rocking by itself.
Yeah.
And Randy says, below that rocking chair is the remains of Sister Abigail.
Yeah.
And he says he's gonna dig him up.
Yeah.
So he gets a pickaxe. Continues talking trash to Bray. Bray is pleading with Randy to not do it.
Yeah, don't do it, man.
But, you know, considering there are, like, different parts of the country, and probably the Orton segment was filmed at an entirely different time, Randy can't hear him.
Yeah.
So, right as Randy finishes his promo, he throws the pickaxe away, stops the rocking chair, and there's happens to be a couple cans of gasoline.
I'm assuming for their lawnmower, riding mower,
yes.
Whoever does their landscaping.
And so he proceeds to douse the interior of that shed with gasoline, the rocking chair. He has removed several floorboards of the shed, exposing the ground underneath which Sister Abigail was laid to rest.
Yeah.
Pours gasoline all over that. Goes to the outside of the shed. Pours gasoline all over that. Leads a trail of gasoline to himself, you know, several feet away from the shed. Lights a match. Drops it on the trail of gasoline. Lights the whole thing on fire.
And poses. Does his Randy Orton
yes.
pose. Yeah.
It's very sinister.
Very, very dark. It's going to be interesting how, like, this sounds to me like there might be some writers in the writing room that are like, okay, he burns a man's house down. The people popped for Bray Wyatt winning the championship. Isn't this a Randy Orton heel turn? No.
Well, no, it's not just burning down a house. It's
desecrating human
yes.
remains. Yeah.
Yes.
His sister. I could see Vince thinking that, no, this is totally a face turn.
I mean, apparently that's how at least a portion of the crowd reacted. There was a Randy chance to close the show.
Yeah.
Confusing to me.
It's very odd. Very strange. And so now, you know, confirmed, Tuesday on SmackDown, we're going to get AJ versus Randy Orton to really determine who the number one contender is. What the fuck? Number 7. Hogan sees Warrior in the mirror.
Yeah, this is weird.
Okay, so this was the storyline that just kept on giving. 1998.
Yes.
1998, the Ultimate Warrior was summoned to WCW.
To collect a huge payday and job to Hogan.
Yeah, so that Hogan could get his victory back, basically, or get his loss back from the Warrior because they fought before WrestleMania 7.
It was in Toronto.
5, 6, 7,
something like that.
I don't think
it's either 6 or 7.
I think it's either 6 or 7. So anyways, and you know, much fanfare. It's funny because, like, you know, people would always mark out for the Warrior because it's the Warrior, but like if you think about it, he had come back like what, 3 times to the
yeah.
WWF, and like each time it was successfully or
successfully shittier.
Yeah, successfully?
No.
Success, what's the word I'm looking for?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Each time, it was crappier than the last.
Yeah.
It was exponentially shittier.
There you go.
In succession, whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
You get me.
Yeah.
So anyways, but still, he came back, and I remember watching live when he actually yeah. showed up. And it's interesting just from like, oh, historically speaking, nostalgic speaking, whatever. It was kind of a cool moment. But he was just, again, a long-winded, bizarre promo that was just, it was absolute crap.
Yes.
And then so Warrior started basically kind of stalking Hogan.
And kind of playing some mind games.
Yeah. And
trying to gain the mental advantage.
One of those mind games, Hogan was searching for Warrior during one particular episode of Nitro.
And followed him into a dressing room.
Yeah, because according to Eric Bischoff, he saw Warrior in the dressing room. And so they go in there. And Hogan is beside himself. He kicks a bunch of other people out that are milling about.
Because it's empty.
And he looks in the mirror, and then the warrior shows up in the mirror.
Yes.
And Hogan is beside himself, and he starts going kind of crazy. And he says, Bischoff, can you see this, brother? Can you see this?
Yeah.
And Bischoff's like, see what? I can't see anything.
And then you hear the commentators are talking this whole time. You hear Larry Zbyszko say, he's in the wall! He's in the mirror.
because was Heenan one of the other commentators or no?
I remember hearing, well, probably because
I know Schiavone's voice.
Heenan was part of the broadcast.
Yeah, yeah.
At the time.
Okay, yeah. And so you hear Schiavone and Heenan both say appropriately, he's in the mirror. And then Schiavone says, he's in the wall.
Zbyszko
says, he's in the wall.
And then he corrects himself.
He's in the mirror.
Yeah.
I swear to God. Larry Zbyszko was the Ralph Wiggum of WCW's commentary team. It was hilarious. And people used to mark out for him. Like when they would open the show,
yeah.
they'd be like, Larry, yeah. Larry. And he'd go back and he'd do the thing. But it's half the shit he was like the forerunner to David Otunga. Like just would say random shit that didn't add anything to the broadcast except for unintentional hilarity.
Yeah.
He's at the wall.
Yeah.
No, actually, he's not.
It's just a two-way mirror.
Yeah, it's just a two-way mirror, man. Yeah, weird. Again, and then you found, I totally forgot about this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think this is related to the Sting-Hogan storyline the year prior.
Some of the best shit that Hogan ever did.
And Bret Hart is making his way out to the ring.
Yeah.
And Hogan has a box.
Yeah.
And he opens the box.
Obviously, somebody had just seen Seven.
Yes. And out of the box, he pulls a rubber version of his own head, and he starts freaking out.
Didn't have sunglasses on it too.
Yeah, yeah. Bandana, sunglasses, everything.
Yeah. I would freak out too. If you said, "Hey, Steve, Merry Christmas," and I opened up a box and it was a Steve head, I'd freak the fuck out too.
Really?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it's funny?
Look, if you did it now, I would think it's hilarious because we're talking about it right now. But if that just happened randomly, I would probably be a little weirded out.
Okay.
Unless there was some context there.
Well, the context is I would be alluding to that incident.
Yeah, I know, but now that we're talking about it, yes.
Before, even still.
I forgot it happened until you showed it to me. Yeah, because then you'd have to explain the joke to me. Then it'd be like...
That's not a very good joke, man.
Remember that? Yeah, exactly. That's a pretty... Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, then Sting shows up on top of the entrance ramp.
Right.
And then he ziplines to the ring.
Exactly. Number six.
Six.
Brian Pillman's gun. This was great. There is an entire... We'll link to this in the description. There is an entire What Culture article. It's the 10 things you didn't know about the Stone Cold Brian Pillman gun incident. And so some of these I got from there.
This is one of your favorite segments or episodes in wrestling history.
Yeah. Oh, of all time, because it introduces a gun into wrestling, and I'm all in favor of that. There's also another gun incident that almost went down and never did, that Tommy Dreamer.
Oh, yeah.
There was supposed to be, because Terry Funk gives this story on Colt Cabana's podcast when he was a guest on it, and he mentioned that Tommy Dreamer, I think, wanted to introduce a gun. He wanted to get shot in the ass to forward an angle. That's fucking insane.
Yeah, that's too much.
I'd like to ask Tommy Dreamer about that.
That's way too much.
But anyway, so during this whole Stone Cold Heart Foundation feud.
Towards the end of 96.
This is November of 96. Stone Cold, who the week before Brian Pillman had dropped this promo on him, calling himself best there is, best there was, best there ever will be, or whatever. So the next week, Stone Cold looking for Brian Pillman, who apparently had legitimately undergone ankle surgery.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, because Stone Cold he kayfabe broke Brian Pillman's ankle the week before. The next week, Stone Cold decides to continue this, and he goes to his house. And Pillman is waiting for him with a gun. And then like the camera, and there's all sorts of like chaos going on. Stone Cold is trying to break into the house. It's shot very documentary style. Like,
well,
it's really happening.
They dedicated a lot of time. You told me the other day, this is the first episode of Raw that went to 2 hours.
Yes, correct.
They dedicated a lot of time of this episode to this storyline.
Mm-hmm,
right. Because I believe Stone Cold threatened to come to Pillman's house. So Pillman,
right.
And I think his real wife or...
It was his real wife.
His real wife.
Yeah.
Were there. And I think Kevin Kelly was there.
Okay.
And a camera crew.
All right, yeah.
And Pillman was there looking all anxious.
Yeah.
And
he looked like he was on bath salts.
And so they kept on cutting back to Pillman's house. Like Vince would throw to it.
Yeah.
And Kevin Kelly would give an update. He's like, no Stone Cold yet.
Yeah.
No Stone Cold yet. Yeah. And at one point, like a truck or something pulls up to the house. And Stone Cold, and he breaks the door in the back of the house or something like that.
Yeah.
Comes in, and then Pillman gets off the couch and points the gun at him, and they cut to commercial, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. No. The episode ends with gunshots.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It cuts to black gunshots, and then we're done. So grim. A couple interesting things about this I found in that article that I hadn't realized before. In the original broadcast on the East Coast feed, Pillman actually said fuck. There's a line. He says, "Let him go. I'm going to kill that son of a bitch. Let him go. Get out of the way. Get out of the fucking way." That aired on live TV.
That's crazy.
Let's see here. USA pre-approved the script with some alterations to it. One of which was apparently his wife was supposed to take some sort of physical bump, either by Stone Cold or maybe Pillman moves her out of the way or something like that. They wanted that cut out of there.
Yeah.
Raw had actually been getting killed in the ratings by Nitro at the time, but that segment virtually tied it with Nitro. So it did actually lead to a spike in the ratings. However, USA executives were so fucking, they were horrified by it.
Yeah.
They got a lot of families call it in, complain about the episode, about that content being too fucked up. One VP wanted to immediately pull Raw from the airways. For the airwaves, rather. And it wasn't until... So they were basically kind of on a probationary thing until the ratings started to go back up, which wasn't that far off. This is November 96 by... Oh, no, I guess, yeah. They They didn't win again until 98, I think. It was like the Stone Cold.
Yeah, it's after WrestleMania. After WrestleMania 14, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
So things started turning around.
They had a little ways to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 96 and 97, Raw was getting decimated week after week.
Yeah. But yeah, this is interesting. You know, Brian Pillman adding to that loose cannon thing of his. He died in 97, is that right?
Sounds right.
Let's see here.
Oh, wait, it was...
He died in, yeah, October. So he died less than a year later. But
yeah, it was the day of the Bad Blood pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So, my goodness gracious, Brian Pillman with a gun. Number five.
Five.
Live sex show starring Edge and Lita.
So Edge had just won the WWE Championship at New Year's Revolution in 2006 on January 9th. Wait, is that when he won the belt?
He won the belt on January 8th and then
okay,
on
sorry.
January 9th.
This is when he cashed in on Cena.
Mm-hmm, right.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the following night on Raw.
Well, I think that night, I want to say that night, this I didn't check, he announced, I think leaving the arena with the title, he announced, tomorrow we're going to have live sex on TV. I think he said something like that. I could be wrong. I could be mistaken that, but I'm pretty sure that happened. Sometimes I have to rely on my memory. It's not very good.
But I noticed, since you didn't want to rely on your memory, that you took extensive notes here of the entire sex show.
Yeah, I did a play-by-play. I watched it, and I did a detailed play-by-play here in our
Please,
notes.
Continue.
Okay, so first, Edge drops a heel promo. This
that.
Is to close out the show.
Yes.
So they announced at the beginning of the show, Lita came out and I think cut a promo on, or Cena was cutting a promo. Lita comes to the head of the ramp carrying the title, looked great. And said that we're going to have sexual intercourse at the end of the show. And Cena was like, is there nudity? So anyways, Edge comes out 15 minutes left in the show, cuts a heel promo. And then they've got a bed. They've got some like pink, purple, red lighting.
Yeah.
You know.
There are sheets on the bed.
There are sheets on the bed. And so then the porno music kicks in because, you know, of course, it's WWE.
Yeah.
Nothing subtle about
it.
No. First, Edge takes his own shoes off. Then Edge takes his own socks off.
Mm.
Okay. Then Edge takes off Lita's boots.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Edge then takes off Lita's top. It's kind of a corset? Like a corset, I think?
Yeah.
So when he takes that off, she's wearing a bra underneath.
Yes.
Then Lita then takes off Edge's jacket.
Mm.
Then Lita takes off Edge's t-shirt.
Mm.
It's an Edge t-shirt.
Makes sense.
Then Edge takes off Lita's skirt. She's not nude. She's wearing panties.
Yes.
Then Lita takes off Edge's belt and pants to reveal that he's wearing black boxer briefs and he's already sporting half a bone. It's sticking straight out. I did notice this as well. Edge has no ass.
Oh.
He's got zero ass. It's like almost negative ass. Then Edge takes Lita, bends her over the bed, and places his dingus firmly in like the butt crack area.
Yeah.
They both have to feel so uncomfortable.
Yeah,
right,
it's going to be super awkward.
So awkward. But to their credit, they do stay in character the entire time.
Yeah.
Like, because, I mean, you know, everything I've seen with Edge and everything I've seen with Lita, they look like $1 million. They're a rock star couple. They,
yes.
If I'd want to see anybody have sex, it'd be these two in the world of wrestling. That being said, whenever I've seen them in interviews, they seem like really cool, down-to-earth people.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just looking down at your notes.
Oh, that's great. And so, because of that, you know, like normal down-earth people, they feel awkward doing this shit.
Oh,
so
yeah.
In their minds, this has to be funny. And I think Edge has even said that he felt uncomfortable as shit doing this.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But they were totally game, and it was awesome. So continuing on with my notes.
Continue, please.
Edge uncouples Lita's bra, and he has a kind of a hard time with it.
Yeah.
And Lawler even says, yeah, sometimes I have a hard time with that too. So he has a hard time, but eventually does it. She grabs her the bra to make sure her boo-boos don't come
yes,
out.
Yes, yes.
They then go under the covers.
Yes.
Edge then throws Lita's bra out of the bed.
Yes. And it was at this juncture that,
I think it was around here.
At the East Coast feed, got a shot
like
of nipple.
Of Lita nipple, exactly. And you can even tell in the network version where they do kind of an awkward fade cut. So let's see here. Then Edge goes downtown meaning cunnilingus.
Yes.
He takes off Lita's undies with his edge mouth.
Yeah.
And he throws the undies out. I'm assuming they were fake undies. Like they were a second pair of undies.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think she really took off her undies.
Yeah.
Then Lita, they switch places. Yeah. And she goes down and eats his dick. Or that's what they're supposed to know.
Yeah.
Because his face is like he's getting a blowjob.
He's got
like,
O face,
like,
huh?
Like this.
It's not. He doesn't have O face?
It's not like this.
No?
It's not like that. It's this could lead to O face.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I'm still getting there.
Gotcha.
At this point, I'm not sure if he's fully engorged or just half engorged like he was earlier. Again, it's an awkward situation.
Yes.
17,000 people are watching this happen. And, like, everybody in the crowd seems horribly uncomfortable, too.
Yes.
Because there's, like, guys like this, like, trying to, like, you know, you don't expect this coming to an episode of Monday Night Raw. You don't expect to see a live sex show. But they were very convincing. Like, this was fucking edgy shit.
Yeah, it was.
You know, pun, excuse me. Continuing on with my notes.
Yes, please.
Flair comes down. Ric Flair, the Intercontinental Champion,
yes,
comes down. Or he's at the top of the ramp, right? His head is already bandaged, so you know he's going to bleed.
Yeah.
Very soon. Flair says Edge has proven that he's a bad champion, and he says tonight you've proven that you're awful in bed as well. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know, Edge is like, so far things seem to be going pretty well in the sex department. Like I think he's doing okay. I'm like, that's all right. I'm good with that. What does Flair mean by that? What is Flair's definition of being good in bed?
Well, I mean, he refers to himself as Space Mountain.
I know. I don't know what that is, though. Like, in my mind, like, Flair's from the old country where, like, it just kind of matters that the dude gets his.
Oh, I don't know.
And so he's probably like, why are you pleasing her? You need to be getting your own nut on. Woo! You know? I don't know. I could be wrong.
Flair does air humps.
Yeah, then Flair
starts thrusting his pelvis.
He offers to have sex with Lita. He says, I'm going to come down and show her how it's done. So, and I'm pretty sure Lita is not consenting to this. So how is Flair not the heel here? You know? So he starts strutting down, like doing his sex strut. He does a weird sex dance.
Yeah.
And then he just starts humping the air. Maybe that's how he gets himself fluffed. him and Edge start fighting. Edge, who's like 50 years younger than Flair,
and
obviously.
Edge is still in his underwear, right?
Shit, that's a good question. I'm almost positive that he was able to get some pants on this time. I could be wrong, but I want to say that he got some pants on, which is impressive because they're leather and they don't just slide like gray sweatpants. So anyways, they start mixing it up. I'm pretty sure he had pants on because otherwise it'd be weird. Edge floors Flair with a chair, unprotected, and he's just bleeding everywhere. He puts Flair up on the table, gives him one concerto, and is about to give him another one. Cena comes out of nowhere, attacks Edge. Edge is able to grab his title. He runs, but Lita's still in the bed. Cena has some really cool kicks, by the way. I don't know what they are, but they look really, really cool.
Oh, yeah.
So Edge is up at the top of the ramp. Cena is like saying, come on, come get some. And then he looks to the ring. And of course, everybody's like, ooh. And so he like peeks under the ring, goes like this. Not bad. He does that. He grabs Lita, who had put on Edge's t-shirt, still wearing, I think she's wearing panties.
Yeah.
And then gives her an AA. I'm sorry, an FU at the time.
Yes.
And Edge won't come down. And that was the end of the live sex show. And the show was over.
Yeah. And a couple weeks, if not a week later, they had Edge and Ric Flair had a ladder match for...
Oh, it was really good.
Edge's belt. Yeah, it was a good match.
Really good match.
Good match.
Yeah. Anyways, that was a live sex show. Sorry it took so long, but I was thoroughly tickled by it.
Yeah, I was going to let you get through all that because you invested a lot of time in documenting every beat of that live sex show.
I did. It made me laugh. So I was laughing so fucking hard. I'm doing this for Larson because then I was going to be cracking up that I did this. What was your face when you first saw the notes and saw that I had done that?
This is pretty much it.
That's great.
I approve, Steve.
Number four.
Four.
ECW's Crucifixion.
Yeah, this took place October 22nd, 1996. The Sandman
mm-hmm.
and Raven were embroiled in a feud where Raven... Oh, that's right.
This is great. This was a really, really like messed up feud.
Yeah. So Raven managed to brainwash Sandman's own kid and ex-wife. Yeah. I believe Sandman's kid caned him at one point, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And he, like, hugged Raven, like, he accepted him as his own dad or like that. So anyways, they decided to kick things up a notch by crucifying Sandman after his match with Two Cold Scorpio at High Incident, which, incidentally, is not available anywhere now.
Yeah.
Brian Lee, Primetime Brian Lee, I'm sorry. Primetime Brian Lee.
Thank you.
And Tommy Dreamer had a pretty epic scaffold match, which later ended up on different compilations. But this...
What, the same show?
At the same show at High Incident, yeah.
Well, I guess it explains the name.
Yeah. And so, but this, the actual card itself is nowhere to be found on DVD. Like, I think you can maybe get it on like Amazon, like through the marketplace, like a bootleg version of it.
Oh, okay.
I checked on eBay because there was a listing for it in the Google search engine, but then when you click on it, it's nowhere to be found. Like, it's not, so I think somebody was selling bootlegs and then WWE shut it down.
Could be. There's a match at High Incident.
Mm-hmm.
Raven, Stevie Richards, and the Blue Meanie crucified the Sandman.
And this Sandman had actually won with the help of his son, so he had gotten his son back. Yeah.
Yeah. And wow, they made a crown of barbed wire.
Yeah, they did that. Yeah, totally. And Sandman had made the cross himself.
Yeah.
So he was all in on this. Like they were both. And that's, I mean, you know, say what you will about this, but that it's kind of heartening to say, oh, two guys really deciding to get creative with things.
Yeah. You know? One person in attendance was not cool with any of this, and that was Kurt Angle.
Yeah, exactly.
Who was contemplating, I believe, going to ECW. Mm-hmm,
possibly, yeah.
Got invited to the show, I believe, by
mm-hmm,
Paul Heyman.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I believe Kurt Angle is a religious man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he took great offense.
Oh, yeah, great umbrage. Yeah.
To this angle.
He saw it, got disgusted, freaked out. He was actually providing commentary on it on the show up to this moment. He walked out when this happened, and he told Paul Heyman, he said, if my name, voice, or likeness come anywhere near this or your company, you will be hearing from my attorneys. And so all that commentary, I mean, like I said, the incident never, or the pay-per-view, the card, never ended up anywhere. So
wow.
That never happened. So yeah, Raven made, and all this entire thing is documented, however, on ECW, the rise and fall of ECW. They talk about it extensively there. Kurt Angle gives his point of view. Paul Heyman gives his point of view. Paul Heyman, of course, says that he didn't know it was going to happen.
I know.
Probably a bunch of shit.
Yep.
Raven was made to apologize after the fact, which he was not happy with. He did it very reluctantly, and that apology, I believe, can be seen on the rise and fall of ECW as well, which is on the network right now.
Yeah, that's a really good documentary.
It is a fantastic documentary. But yeah, it's, he, you know, Raven obviously is not into it. And Raven had big problems apologizing. He said, you know, the fans aren't going to, you know, I'm a heel. Like the fans, they don't want to hear an apology.
Yeah.
Anyways. ECW, man. They did some really crazy shit.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Number three.
Three.
Muhammad Hassan. In 2005, the WWE decided to run with this character named Muhammad Hassan, who is actually a fellow named Mark Capani. Mark Capani, yeah. Total stud. Really good wrestler. Good-looking guy. But they decided to do one of these things that WWE does sometimes where they try to get edgy and they try to get real world. Of course, obviously, this was... Oh, he debuted in December 2004. This was 3 years after 9/11. So... Shit was still pretty, I mean, you know, you were older in 2001. I was older in 2001. We remember vividly all stuff.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, the country was still pretty much on edge.
Yeah. America was still embroiled in two wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One in Afghanistan, one in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And so the WWE decided to do the thing where they, you know, try to get current, try to get sociopolitical, perhaps.
Yeah.
And as it always ends up, it fell completely flat.
Oh, yes.
It's just not a good idea.
No.
He described himself, I'm pulling this from Wikipedia right here. He described himself as an Arab American wrestler wanting relief from the increased prejudice and stereotypes created by the 9/11 attacks as he enters into professional wrestling. Recently with Mustafa Ali, for example.
Yes.
They went about this in a way which I thought was totally cool.
Oh, yeah, it was.
He said, you know, I go places and people look at me a certain way and I'm looking to change people's perceptions of me.
Yes.
And at first he was presented as kind of a heel with a chip on his shoulder.
Yes.
And then he said, you know what? I've been welcomed by people and it's been very heartening. And then he transitioned into a face.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, cool. That's sort of, that does the trick. That's good. That's good enough.
Yeah.
With Muhammad Hassan, they were taking this in a completely different way.
Yeah.
So on an episode of SmackDown taped on July the 4th, 2005, Teddy Long put Hassan in a match against The Undertaker at the Great American Bash.
Yeah, and then Daivari had a match that night against The Undertaker.
Yeah, Daivari was his manager.
Okay, Daivari lost.
Yeah.
But Hassan was on the ramp and started praying.
Yeah, he started doing the prayer.
And then five masked men dressed in black shirts, ski masks, and camo pants came out.
Armed with clubs and a piano wire, they choked out The Undertaker, beat him up, and carried him to Hassan, who then... No, Hassan came down, put him in the camel clutch. Then they lifted Daivari above their heads and carried him away. I remember watching this live and being fucking shocked.
Yeah.
Because, okay, you have to understand, this was when people were being beheaded.
Yes.
Out there in the Middle East. Daniel Pearl, the reporter, the journalist,
yeah.
He was beheaded in February 2002. So that was about
three years
removed from this. Nick Berg, who was a businessman out there,
he was beheaded a year prior.
So yeah. This is... And I don't recommend anybody ever look at these videos because they're horrible, but I did at the time. But it was guys dressed exactly the way that they're dressed here in this WWE pro wrestling segment. Men dressed in camo pants, ski masks, and black shirts. And I don't want to see that in my entertainment.
No.
Nobody wants to see this in their entertainment.
No. So, continue.
To make the matter worse, 3 days after the taping, so on July 7th.
The day this SmackDown was scheduled to air.
I believe so, yeah. The London bombings took place. Basically, in short order, USA Network, to make a long story short, they said, we don't want this anywhere near anything ever. Get rid of this character. And so, like, on the next episode of SmackDown, I think, his lawyer came down and read a statement. They were shipped down to developmental, and then they were eventually just released. He ended up retiring from professional wrestling altogether.
Okay.
But according to several sources, he was in line. If they hadn't pushed this far,
yeah,
he was in line for a title shot
mm-hmm.
and a run with the world title. I don't know which one. I think there were two at this time.
Yeah.
He was released September 21st, 2005, so just a couple months later.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, in subsequent years, it was real, according to this is Wikipedia again. He was planned to receive a major push, eventually winning the World Heavyweight Championship from Batista at SummerSlam.
Wow.
Instead, he did have that match at the Great American Bash. He was absolutely destroyed by The Undertaker. He gave him a last ride off of a ramp through a table, and he literally disappeared in like a hole or some shit. I forget exactly what happened. But yeah, then that was the last anybody had ever seen of
him. Wow.
So yeah, they got rid of him in short order. But it was a bummer. He was a good wrestler. He was a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
If they had simply taken a tact that wasn't so blatantly shocking and offensive.
I know.
Like, you didn't need to go there.
No.
You don't, like, real people are affected by this stuff.
Yeah.
Why are you going there?
I don't know. It seemed like in the mid-aughts, WWE was just, you know, the Attitude Era gets a lot of notice for being shocking.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like some of the stuff they were doing in the mid-aughts was just...
I know.
Like, why would you go there?
I know. It's like It's like in the Attitude Era, it was shocking by way of, ooh, we almost saw a booby. You know what I mean? Or like, I mean, the unprotected headshots is one thing because it's like we didn't really know how bad that shit was, like the hardcore wrestling,
yeah.
What it did to people. But yeah, I feel like in the aughts, they were just trying to get attention.
Yeah, four of these entries are from the early mid aughts.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Five. Half of this list.
Yeah, you're right.
Because Mae Young was 2000.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the odds, number two.
Two.
Vince's limo blows up.
So this took place June 11th, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Vince McMahon was in a storyline where...
This is true.
I know. It's funny to me, though.
He lost the ECW title...
To Lashley.
To Bobby Lashley.
And fell into a depression.
Yeah. And so the next night on Raw, they had a Mr. McMahon appreciation night where throughout the night they would cut to interview vignettes of various people from his past, and they would just run him down. One of them was Jesse Ventura, hot off hot off being governor.
That's funny.
Of Minnesota.
So it was like the roast of Vince McMahon.
Yeah, exactly. And so McMahon basically broken down by this, like he was completely in a state of depression.
Yeah.
He comes out to the ring. He mumbles some like nonsense, like does some like half-hearted thank yous kind of. Like one of them was Stone Cold. He was just ripping into him. Basically, he's a useless sack of shit. Ventura calls him a dictator.
Wow.
He says, you know, very few people I refer to as Mr., but I call him Mr. McMahon. Do you know why?
Why?
Because that's what I refer to as dictators in this fine democracy of ours. Anyways, and there's a bunch more. Vince goes backstage, and everybody, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think, this is kind of like something out of a, I don't know, like a Hitchcock film, or like, it reminds me of the Orson Welles version of The Trial.
Oh, yeah.
With Anthony Perkins, where everybody's staring at him, and he doesn't know why,
you know?
It reminds me of that, or like the birds, when all the birds are just chilling out there.
Oh, yeah, when Tippi Hedren's sitting, and all the birds are on the bars.
Exactly.
The playground bars,
so it's like all these people, all like the superstars, like the non, you know, the not, it's obvious watching this how forgettable the 2007 roster really was. I mean, you've got guys like, and one of the standouts was Paul London and Brian Kendrick.
Yeah, yeah. They were
fantastic.
But yeah, they were tag team champions forever.
Yeah, but apparently Paul London was just a nightmare to deal with. Like, apparently he was like a really immature guy backstage.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's what, like, a bunch of shoot interviews that I listened to about this. Because there was, like, everybody was backstage, and they all kind of had these, like, sort of judgmental looks on their face, like, staring at McMahon, like, everybody fucking hated him but couldn't say anything, which is kind of probably the case. But Paul London just had this big grin on his face. And according to a shoot interview with him, he was like, yeah, we weren't really given any direction. We were all what I consider wrapping paper.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to tell you what's going on. You're just going to stand there and stare at him. And he was like, I just did what I felt was right. And so I just smiled. That was his take on it. So anyways, we're backstage, a bunch of wrestlers sort of giving him the weird staring at him treatment. It was a very bizarre scene.
Yeah.
He exits out the back door. His limo's waiting for him. He gets in the limo and it just blows up.
I remember he gets in his limo. They cut to a close up of him where he's starting to get in the limo and he kind of just looks around with a disgruntled look on his face.
Yeah.
Gets in, closes the door, cut to a wide shot, limo blows up.
Well, no, what's interesting about it is that they actually did it fairly seamlessly where in the same shot as he's closing the door, so you see him get in and close the door, is the same shot where it blows up.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then like they do some more angles on the actual burning wreck, but the actual shot where he gets in is the same one. So they did that pretty seamlessly.
Wow.
Yeah. So now the weird thing about this was that the WWE was totally playing this up like it was real.
Yeah.
Like on their website. And it even, their stock tumbled.
Yeah.
Because of this, because they were acting like, people thought, like, people were giving Trump, like, there was some revelation recently.
Oh, Triple H said something about it, didn't he?
Yeah, Donald Trump thought that he was actually dead.
Yeah.
A lot of people did because the WWE were treating it this way. And then, like, a week later, they came out to, like, CNBC and said, no, it's all part of a storyline.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what the fuck? So they were getting calls from business people. There was, like, a memorial thing set up. And then Chris Benoit... That tragedy struck.
Yeah.
So, like, there was a week after, this was June 11th, June 18th, they did a Raw where the storyline kind of continued.
Yeah, and then the following week.
The following week on the 24th, which I think was the date of an ECW pay-per-view.
Okay.
The Benoit tragedy happened. The next day, Raw opened up with McMahon standing in the middle of the ring, empty arena, and he addressed the situation saying, tonight we're going to do a tribute. We're still figuring out what happened. They did the tribute show.
Before they knew what really happened.
Before they knew what really happened. And then I think on the next episode to air of any WWE programming, I think was ECW. God, it might have been SmackDown, though.
Well, SmackDown was, wasn't ECW was on Wednesday?
Was it on Wednesdays at the time? I know at one point on Sci-Fi it was on Fridays.
Oh, maybe it was SmackDown then, because that was on Thursday.
But I just remember that at one point, like the very next episode of whatever WWE was,
he showed up and he said, now that we know what happened and what kind of a monster he was, this is the last time you're ever going to hear me say his name. We're going to continue on entertaining you, but you'll never hear about him again.
Mm-hmm.
And they've stayed true to their word. And, you know, obviously the angle is dropped and never brought up again.
Yeah.
Number one.
One.
Katie Vick. Ooh. Did you end up watching this?
No.
No, you didn't?
I've read about it. I've seen a little bit of it.
Okay.
Previously.
Okay.
You know, and I'm good.
It's horrible.
It is.
It is so bad. So this is terrible. October 7th, 2002.
Sorry.
Triple H was at the height of his like burial phase when he was burying people left and right.
Yeah. So Triple H is in a feud with Kane.
Yeah.
And accuses him of being a murderer.
He comes out at the end of an episode of Raw on October 7th and he says, Kane, does the name Katie Vick ring a bell? And immediately when somebody says something like that with like a horribly contrived name, it's like, this is going to be stupid. Like you knew immediately when he says this, before he even says murder, you know it's going to be stupid.
Yeah.
And then he says, you're a murderer. And you're like, oh, fucking, this is going to be terrible. This is going to be horrible.
I know.
And so sure enough, the next week, Kane cuts a promo in front of the live crowd talking about when he was younger, he had been drinking and driving, crashed his car while his girlfriend, Katie Vick, was in it and she died and he got injured really badly.
Yeah.
I can't begin to name the number of problems with that story. The fact that it completely destroys the character of Kane.
I know.
Like, is he a demon from hell? Is he not a demon from hell? Is he Undertaker's brother? Why would Undertaker's brother have a girlfriend and he's drinking at a party?
Yeah.
None of it made sense. It was so stupid. It was so dumb.
And so the following week.
Yeah.
Triple H.
There is one redeeming thing about this.
Triple H sporting a Kane mask and a t-shirt that said.
Well, big red freaking machine.
Okay.
He sets it up with an interview with Jonathan Coachman backstage, and he says, I've got the proof or evidence or whatever right here. He's a sick freak.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they cut to the video.
And it's a recreation of
her funeral.
Katie Vick's funeral.
Yeah, so there's a casket there. Triple H, as Kane, walks in.
Yeah.
And it's such a long segment.
I know.
It goes on forever. He starts talking to her. Acting like she's talking back to him, and he's like, oh, I just want to touch you, and he like starts feeling up her boobs, and then that blurs out, and then he like reaches down, he like takes off her panties, he undresses, and he's got his weird Triple H thong on, you know, like that's weird, and then he gets in the casket and he has sex with her, and I like the camera cuts to like candles, like that has like cutaways, and then it cuts back to him and he says, oh, was that good for you too? And he says, he starts acting like she's talking back to him. He says, oh, I did. And his hand pulls up like this viscous nastiness from her head. And he says, I screwed your brains out.
That's so gross.
It is so over the line gross. It is so fucked up.
Yeah.
There's nothing redeeming about it except when they cut back, Triple H is laughing. And you have to give credit to the fact when somebody laughs at their own joke, it's kind of funny. Because when it's so stupid, when it's so over the line offensive, for somebody, the guy who made this, to think it's funny, that can be funny. That to me.
Wow.
Well, I was watching the video yesterday or 2 days ago, and I saw it, and I started chuckling when I saw him laughing at his own stupid, horrible joke. That's kind of funny. Anyways,
that's awful.
Over the next couple of weeks, they virtually drop the angle. HBK shows up. He starts feuding with Triple H.
Yeah.
The Kane thing is dropped. The Katie Vick thing is dropped. But
they all realize it was a horrible, 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 horrible idea.
And everybody has ever since that point referred to the Katie Vick thing as like one of the worst things ever to happen in pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Because it's so bad. But again, him laughing at his own joke is kind of mildly amusing to me. He thought he was so clever. And the funny thing is, he probably really did think he was so clever for producing that. It's so bad.
It's so bad.
But anyways, those are the 10 biggest WTF moments. Look, there's plenty in pro wrestling.
Yes.
We hit up our good friendos on the Patreon, and so thank you to everybody for kicking in your responses. Let us know what you guys think in the comments. as to, I mean, there's a bunch of others, but those are the 10 that we can think of that really were like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Anyways, that's it for Countout. Until next time, we'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.